Get a deeper connection with the Cougars of BYU Sports.
God gives us a gift, and we use that gift until he takes it away.
Deep Blue.
Just sitting down afterward and being really tired and thinking like, wow, I just won the U.S. championship.
This is Deep Blue. Here's your host, Jason Shepherd.
Thanks for tuning in for a new episode of Deep Blue. This is the show where we get to know the person behind the number that you see on the field or the court. These are the true stories of BYU athletes from their own mouths. My guest today is Super Bowl winning coach, a former BYU player and coach, and now BYU Hall of Famer. He's Brian Billick. Brian, thank you so much. It is a pleasure to talk with you. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I am doing great.
So we talked about all of your accolades, and we're gonna give all of it its just due. We'll touch on all of those things throughout the course of the podcast. But what's keeping you busy these days?
Chasing my grandkids around and playing a lot of golf. I picked the game up about 3 years ago. I've become addicted, like intervention addicted. It's not good, but it's great. And we moved to Columbus, Ohio, where my grandkids are, chasing them around with all their sports and activities. So keeping me busy and lots of fun.
There you go. Well, after such an eventful career and life so far, did you ever think that you would be coming back to BYU to be inducted into the Hall of Fame?
I told the story before. When Greg Vihar called me, we have a lake home up in Minnesota where we spend the summers. And Greg had called. I did not know Greg. And he was telling me about the Hall of Fame. And I was confused because I'm not sure. You're putting who in the hall, and you want me to introduce them or what? What exactly is it you want me to do here? He goes, no, we'd like to put you into the Hall of Fame. So it was an unexpected honor. It was a great event, great to interact and be around the other inductees on, just a thrill to be around. Of course, Dave Rose went in, Jennifer Hampson. I'm not even going to try to pronounce Foodie's name. I'll just mess it up. And I don't, what a wonderful young man he was. And of course, Matt Payne and Lacey Kramer Blizzard went in. So, and to hear their stories, and it was a great group, it was a great evening, and really enjoyed it. Felt honored and humbled by it.
Do you still feel pride coming back to be? I don't know how often you are able to come back, but when you come back, what are those feelings like for you?
It is amazing. When I have not been back a lot. I do go to Utah every winter to ski up in Deer Valley, but have not been back to BYU for a number of years. First, I'm in absolute awe of the growth. I mean, I'm old. Back when 50 years ago when I was at BYU, you got out of Orem, you didn't see anything till you were well past the point of the mountain headed toward the airport. I mean, there was just nothing out there. And now just to see the growth and everything that's involved there and to be back and to go to the stadium, that was a great thrill to go to the game at the stadium. Obviously, the energy, the atmosphere, everything that's grown up around it, it's great fun. It's always great to reconnect. Was honored that Coach asked me to visit with the team a little bit. So before the Kansas State game, which was a big game, and to look into the eyes of the young men and see the energy and the love they had for the game, it was great, great honor.
What do you make of what BYU is doing now in a completely different situation now in the Big 12, in a power league, and doing well? This program has certainly elevated itself over the decades, hasn't it?
It has, you know, and we had the 50-year reunion prior to my induction to the Hall of Fame a couple weeks before the opener. We had the 50-year reunion for the first bowl team, which was the 74 team. And they had said at that time that BYU in the 50 years prior was ranked like 120th, 115th in total wins in the program. And in the last 50 years, and very proud of being a part of that group that kind of kicked it off. I think we're currently eighth or ninth in the NCAA in terms of total wins. So to see the program grow and take off from that point, very, very gratifying. It was great to reconnect with those guys and to just see the program itself, the facilities, everything about it.
Yeah, certainly a lot of fun. And as you mentioned, you know, you were part of the foundation of this program, and we're going to get into that in a minute. But let's go back. And by back, I mean all the way back. You were born in Ohio, but you were raised in Redlands, California. When did you move to the Inland Empire?
Yeah, it's amazing. My father was in the military, my entire family of five kids, very uncharacteristic military history. Usually when I talk to people and they're military brats like me, I lived in five, six, seven, eight places. We lived in two places. My dad was a test pilot. So we, Wright-Patterson, which is in Dayton, I'm in Columbus right now, and Dayton's about 80, 90 miles west of us. My father's from Toledo. My mother's from Marietta. So all very, very deep Ohio roots. But when I was four, we moved to Los Angeles, where my dad test had moved from Ohio out to the West Coast. So we ended up in Redlands, California. He moved around a little bit, but a very uncharacteristic of a military family. All five kids born in the same military hospital. All five kids graduated from the same high school. So it was a great transition for us. Loved growing up in Southern California. Redlands at that time, was a major football power, small town. But, you know, it was typical Friday night lights.
Yeah.
You know, there'd be 8,000-9,000 people at the games. It was the only high school in that area. Now there's like four or five. But it was a great transition. Loved growing up there. Great environment to learn the game and become a part of it.
You mentioned high school. You lettered in both basketball and football. Growing up, what role did sports play in your life, or maybe even just in the overall family?
Well, it was huge. My family, my father and my brother, I have two sisters, two brothers, and of course my father, and they weren't necessarily into the sports scene, but I got into it early. And in an environment in high school that was just sports crazy, a real strong football tradition. In fact, I think I look back at that. I can remember wanting to be a coach almost as long as I can remember wanting to play, because the high school coach was such a figure in the town. Paul Womack was our high school coach, legendary coach, and had such a presence. And so obviously was drawn to the sports there, and then transitioned into Brigham Young. So very much a sports oriented town, and loved playing football and basketball there.
You played both quarterback and defensive back in high school. Is that correct?
Yeah. In fact, I still very proud. Still hold the all time interception record. Not throwing interceptions, getting interceptions.
It's at 23, right?
Yeah, in California. Yeah. So I was a free safety and covered a lot of ground. So and particularly, you know, back then nobody threw the ball a lot. It's not like it is now. So to come up with 21 or 23 interceptions was pretty cool.
I love the fact that you still know that you hold that record in the state of California.
It comes up every now and then.
Okay, so out of high school, you commit to the Air Force Academy. Did you go there to play football, or were you looking to pursue a career in the Air Force?
You know, it was in one of those young, stupid moments that you have sometime. I mean, I very much wanted to play football, wanted to continue to go, but I came from a military family. So the draw of the Air Force Academy was very, very strong. I should not have gone there, and it wasn't the Air Force Academy fault. It just wasn't the place for me, and it wasn't where my ambitions lie. So I went through training, or what they call boot camp during the summer, got through the first half of the year and realized, this probably isn't what I need to be doing. And at that point, transferred to BYU.
What was it about BYU? Why was that the place that was the right place for you that you ultimately decided to go?
Well, when I had left the academy, I'd come home, and Dick Felt, a longtime Hall of Fame member as well, defensive coordinator, had recruited me to BYU. He was aware that I had come back. He contacted me, said, would I be interested in coming to BYU? They were beginning to throw the ball, and I knew I was going to play tight end. And so I figured, well, hey, this will be the place for me to maybe go where they're going to throw the ball a lot. At the time, UCLA was the other big draw for me, but they were under Pep Rogers. They were running the wishbone. So I thought, this isn't a hard decision. So I ended up going to BYU, really not knowing a lot about BYU, to be honest with you. Yeah. And I'm not a member of the church. So going into that environment, it was very, very interesting, very educational.
Your first year with the Cougars was Gary Scheide's senior year, and I get to work with Gary a lot on some of the broadcasts here at BYU, which is so much fun. Truly one of the nicest people that anybody will ever meet. And then Gifford Nielsen took over at quarterback. What was it like playing with them in such a unique offense in college football at the time?
Yeah, because people need to remember back then, they were really ahead of the curve. I mean, when you look at the programs that ushered in the throwing the football to the degree that we now know it, at that time, it just wasn't done. BYU, maybe Stanford. Of course, in the pro ranks, Bill Walsh was revolutionizing the way even the pro game was being played and throwing the ball. So being there when at that beginning, and Gary was, you know, the slumped shoulder, Joe Namath, one, you know, look-alike type of deal, and he's flinging the ball. Dewey Warren was our coordinator and out of Tennessee, and he'd have thrown it every snap if Lavelle would have let it. And it was very, very open, kind of seat of your pants, make it up as you go, throwing it all over the place. And I got to know Gifford a great deal more because Gary, you know, I had come in, I had a red shirt. And so with Gifford, I worked more with Gifford than I did with Gary. Because Gary was the starter and obviously doing a brilliant job.
In your first two seasons as a Cougar, BYU started out 0-3. Lavelle's still fairly new being the head coach. And I think a lot of times the teams of the 80s get talked about a lot for obvious reasons, but it was those teams of the 70s that you were a part of that really laid the groundwork for what those early to mid 80s teams would do. Talk to me about the program when you were there and give everyone a sense of what was building at that time. Could you feel what was building, or when you're in it, you're just not aware of it?
Well, no, I don't know that we understood, certainly couldn't foresee that we were laying the foundation. We knew we were a team in transition, and we knew we were building something a little bit different. And I remember that time. And again, at that time, the program, I mean, it was, you know, we only half joked about it. We weren't exactly top shelf. You know, we go on the road. I always joke we stayed at whatever Motel 6, and the only reason we stayed there is because there's no such thing as a Motel 5, or would have been there. There wasn't a lot of assets being thrown at it at that time. Of course, the stadium was only 30,000. But Lavelle had come in and had the foresight that he was going to change that, and he did so by going, "We're going to be different. We're going to throw the ball." And that was exciting to be a part of that and to see that transition. And I tell the story, it's amazing how single moments in the evolution of a program or a career. You're right. In that 74 season, we started out 0-3, and it was a bad 0-3. We had lost to Utah State. We went to Iowa State and just got our butts handed to us. I think it was 34-7, something like that. So we come back and we're going to play Colorado State on the road. And the night before, as you typically do, you get together as a team, and Lavelle, and again, Lavelle was not a fiery and brimstone, you know, eloquent, you know, fire you up type. Lavelle was just very personable. The relationship with the players was very close. And I remember very vividly after that meeting thinking, boy, if we don't win this game, if we don't turn this around, he may resign. From a very selfless point, look, I'm not getting it done. You guys need more. And I don't know that that was for a fact, but visiting with the coaches that were there at the reunion, there was clearly, it was not going to end well if we could not get that thing turned around. And then we even tied Colorado State. We didn't even win that game. And then went on that 7-game winning streak. And to see from that moment on how it had changed to now 50 years of a top 10 program and everything that we just talked about when we started this. Lavelle, a Hall of Fame career that could have easily gone a different way. It's amazing to think back of the nuance of that moment and how that specific nexus in time developed into just a fairy tale story.
Well, and continuing with the laying the groundwork theme, you touched on this a little bit ago, talking about going to the program's first ever bowl game. It was the Fiesta Bowl against a ranked Oklahoma State team. What was that experience like, and what did that mean for you guys and for BYU as a whole to be the team that did it first?
Yeah, I don't, again, as young players, I don't know that we recognize as much now to be that first team ever. But I remember it was an exciting time, and because it was so unexpected, and nobody had really ever done this before. So all of it was, wow, this is cool. We get to do this, we get to do that, and you go to the bowl game, and the coaches included. It was kind of a wide-eyed, oh, okay, this is how this works. And then of course, the next year we played okay. The next year after that is where we really kind of solidified it. I think it was the Tangerine Bowl. We went back to played Oklahoma State again.
Yeah, you were 9-3 that year.
Right, and so that's where beating Arizona State in Arizona, which at the time was the big deal, beating Utah. It was really then that second success for me. Looking back on it, is when I really felt like, okay, now, you know, first year was cool and that was neat and special, and it's great to look back on it. But that for me now, after solidifying with that 9-3 season, was okay. Yeah, this thing could be for real and go forward.
What made that team specifically, your senior year, the 9-3 team, what made that team so successful?
Well, we were very confident. The 74 team was more of excited, seizing the moment. The excitement grew, but that 90 or 76 team was one that we knew we could be good. And of course, Doug Scoville had come in now and refined the passing game, where we really were the preeminent throwing team in all of college football. And we took pride in that, and that gave us a great deal of confidence, because we knew we were doing something different and better than anybody else in the league, in the NCAA.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We will have more with BYU Hall of Famer Brian Billick. You're listening to the Deep Blue Podcast on BYU Radio. Thanks again to everyone out there for listening to the Deep Blue Podcast. Make sure you leave us a rating and a review on the show. You should always check out other BYU Radio podcasts as well, like Big Stories. Cleon Wall dives into incredible and amazing tales from around the Big 12 and beyond, like Kansas offensive coordinator and former BYU coach Jeff Grimes. He and his wife Sherry decided early in their marriage that they wanted to adopt a child from another country. They detail their long journey to adopting Jada from Africa and how that girl changed their family dynamic. And then there is Wyoming women's rodeo coach J.C. Hupp, who lost her parents and niece in a terrible accident but continues to lead the cowgirls in the rodeo arena. There are so many more inspiring stories just like these two tales, so check out Big Stories on your favorite podcast platform and start listening today. Welcome back to the Deep Blue Podcast here on BYU Radio. I'm your host, Jason Shepherd. So happy to have our guest. He is a Super Bowl winning coach. He is also now a BYU Hall of Famer. He is the great Brian Billick. And we were talking about your senior season at BYU. At what point did you realize the NFL was going to be an option for you?
Well, you always covet that, and that's something you work towards. Again, the fact that we were throwing the ball, I was able to do some things and highlight some abilities that showed that, yeah, you can go into the NFL, you know, because not a lot of tight ends were catching balls at the time. And so you're hopeful. Ended up being, 11th round draft. I didn't have 11 rounds now. I would have been an undrafted free agent. But having that opportunity to go into the NFL, drafted by the 49ers, then eventually getting cut there, eventually joining the Cowboys, which was an education itself, going to the 49ers at the time. That was an organization, just an absolute mess. Terrible team, terrible structure, terrible organization. And then going to the Dallas Cowboys, you know, America's team, the preeminent team in all the NFL, and to watching how that organization worked, it was quite a tutelage for me in those 2 years.
You had mentioned earlier that, you know, you had always found the coaching side of it as appealing as playing, if not maybe even more, and you saw that. When you got into the NFL and the NFL career did not play out the way that you wanted, did you know the direction that this was heading for you?
Oh, absolutely. I went back after I got cut by the Cowboys. I went back to Southern California and I volunteered because the season had already started. So coming back to BYU or going to graduate school, you know, normal way of being a GA and trying to get a coach that way, that had obviously moved on. So I had come back and I volunteered at my high school. Paul Womack, I alluded to earlier, legendary high school coach. Well, University of Redlands, which is an NAIA division school, Frank Sorrell, who was a legendary high school coach and then became a small college legend in college football. I volunteered at the U of R with Frank Sorrell, and he was gracious enough to let me in. Great, great year learning from someone that had great empathy for the players, great football mind. Well, my high school coach, one of his coaches ran into some difficulty, so he actually hired me to come then in coach quarterbacks and receivers. So in that 1 year, I'd coach the high school from 2 to 4, then go to the U of R practice from 4 to 6. Friday night was the high school game. Saturday, take the film off. Saturday afternoon or Saturday night was the college game. Take that film off on. So I got 2 seasons in 1 under 2 legendary coaches. So I learned a great deal about the coaching profession and what I wanted to do going forward. Then went to BYU to graduate assist and had a great time there. Obviously reconnecting with Vel in the program and working with the coaches as coaches obviously was a big step for me as well in terms of learning the profession and everything that went with that.
You know, with as busy as I'm sure you were getting into the coaching profession, how did you find time to be a contestant on the Match Game?
You know, that comes up when I went back. As I said, I went back to and worked at my high school in a small college there in Redlands. But I needed work. So I worked at the YMCA and I did fitness training for housewives and business leaders, you know, businessmen, and whatever, in a nice weight room. And the TV was always on, and they're watching it as we're working out. And the Match Game was up there. And I thought, well, that's in LA, and I can make money. I can do that. So I wrote in. They had me come in, and it was an interesting experience. Didn't get a single point, but it was. I will tell you, I don't go a month that someone doesn't. Oh, I saw you on the Match Game. You know, the way it replays now on. With all the streaming, yeah. Whatever, it's amazing how that has continued to resonate some, 45 years later.
Yeah, I highly recommend. Now I remember it not in first run, but certainly in reruns. And so I'm well aware of what the Match Game is. I love watching, I mean, Richard Dawson and Betty White and Charles Nelson Reilly. I mean, the whole crew. If you have never seen the Match Game, it is certainly of a certain era. But it is something that is very entertaining to watch. Maybe, who knows? Maybe one of the episodes that you watch will have Brian Billick on it. Who knows?
It was great fun. It was great fun.
Okay, so I want to go back to you said you came back to BYU and you were a grad assistant. I'm curious what that was like to having been a part of the team and sort of seeing it from that angle. Now coming to BYU and being a peer of Lavelle and all of those coaches, which we know what the Lavelle coaching tree looks like. It's insane.
Yeah, and I don't know that I was a peer. I was just a minion that did that. But the great thing about it, at that time, we had a JV team. So not only was you're helping with the varsity and doing all the things you do as a GA, but we kind of had our own team, a JV team, that you now actually got to coach. And we actually had games. And that was great for and to be involved. And some of the players most of the players that I had played with when I had come back were obviously on the varsity, so we had a lot of the younger players that came in. So you got to actually work with them. You were older, so they actually looked at you like a coach, as opposed to working with the guys that some who I had actually even played with. So working with that young, I remember one time a great story. We went down. We were playing UNLV, so our typical day was we would service the varsity, the young team, the freshmen. We'd service the varsity as the scout team. And they were playing Wyoming. Well, Wyoming was running the wishbone. So we're running the wishbone off of cards and the whole thing, getting the defense ready. And then practice would be over, and then we'd have the JV practice for 20, 30 minutes afterwards and do our thing. Well, we're driving on the bus down to Las Vegas. And again, we're BYU. We're throwing the ball 50 times a game. And I think it was Steve Young. Steve Young was the quarterback, and Steve Young had run the veer and the bone in high school. So we, Jay Miller, I think, was kind of our head coach, and we're going down going, hey, the guys know the offense. We just ran it all week for the varsity. Let's come out in the wishbone. So they're expecting us to be spread, throw the ball. We come out in the wishbone. It was the funniest thing you've ever seen. We marched right down the field and score. The opposing coaches, chalk was flying, boards were, you know, they're trying to coach up all of a sudden. You know, okay, well, you take the pitch and you take the quarterback and you take the dive. And it was great fun. It was that kind of coach by the seat of your pants. It was a great experience.
You know, we hear from a lot. I mean, it's probably too many to even count. Former players or people who coached with Lavelle, and they always talk certainly about what he was able to do for them, either on the field or as a coach and helping them. But almost everybody to a man talks about the type of person he was and the relationship that they forged with him. Do you feel the same way that was, if not as strong, maybe even stronger than anything he taught you on the field?
Oh, absolutely. That's what Lavelle was all about. Lavelle really didn't coach a lot, per se. He let his assistants do that. And as now, you know, a head coach myself or former head coach, I recognize the value of that. He trusted his people. He let them take the lead and coach the players. Lavelle was very much about managing the team and pushing the players towards the leadership of the assistant coaches. And so there was that a natural affinity because you really felt like you had your best interest in mind, and always very calm, always very kept the priorities in the proper place. And you realized that you were important to him. You weren't just a player to fabricate the program and go forward. So great opportunity for me to learn from someone like Lavelle Edwards, that quality of being a head coach.
After BYU, then you go have a couple of different stops in college. At San Diego State, you're a tight ends coach there. Utah State, you're the OC. Then you go to Stanford as both the assistant head coach as well as a tight ends coach. Then an opportunity comes in the NFL. Talk to me about, we'll get to going to the Vikings in a second, but after BYU, a couple of different places, as you're sort of, you know, fine-tuning your craft, what was that time like for you? I assume you probably look back on it, and that's sort of where you get into the nitty-gritty and you really learn how to be a coach, right?
Kind of a unique path for me in that I'm at BYU and I'm GA. So and you're looking for the normal things of GA, trying to make those connections and thinking about, well, how do I get hired someplace? Who do I hook up with? This typically, it's relationships. Well, when I was in Dallas playing with the Cowboys, a gentleman named George Heddleston was the assistant PR director. Well, Bill Walsh, who had just taken over the San Francisco 49ers, hires George Heddleston as his PR director. And Bill was looking for a former player. Now every team in the league has a player program guy. He's the guy that is kind of a liaison between the organization, the coach, and the players. And Bill was the first one to ever do that. So he used the PR department. He had George. He said, I want a former player that can do what you need to do for PR, but he's going to kind of be my player programs person. So I take great pride in actually being the first player programs individual, I think, in the NFL. And so I go to that opportunity. Well, for 2 years, I'm just a assistant PR program. I'm just a gopher, okay? Bill Walsh puts the organization of John Ralston, John McVay, Tony Dungy's on that staff, Denny Green, Sam Weiss, George Seifert. End up being a who's who of coaches. And Denny Green, of course. And these are the guys that I get to interact with. And did that for 2 years. And then Doug Scovel, who was at BYU, got the head job at San Diego State. I knew I wanted to get back to the coaching, actual coaching side. So Doug hires me to go down to San Diego State. So I had that 2-year sabbatical, so to speak, unbelievable mentorship for me to learn about organizationally about the National Football League at the true ground roots level across the board that served me so well going forward. So I got in San Diego State with Doug for 5 years, then get the opportunity to be the offensive coordinator at Utah State, which was great fun. But then Denny Green, and typical in any profession, it's kind of who you know and is that next step. Denny Green gets the job at Stanford University. So Denny hires me from Utah State to come to Stanford. And I'm with Denny there for 3 years. We have a good deal of success. He gets the opportunity then to go on to Minnesota with the Minnesota Vikings, asks me to go with him. And that was my first real foray into coaching in the NFL.
were you the type that was just, you know, I'm going to let this take me wherever it takes me? Was it a goal for you to get to the NFL? Were you very content to be a college coach? What was your thought process with that?
Yeah, very much interested in getting into the NFL. Of course, pursuing looking at college head jobs as well. I interviewed for a couple. One was at Fresno State, Utah State. When I was at Stanford, I went back when they let Chuck Shelton go and interviewed for that job. But very much wanted to go to the NFL, and having been there and interacted and worked at that level. So the opportunity to go with Denny to Minnesota was, and for whatever reason, I don't know why, I was a huge Minnesota Viking fan growing up. Grant Tarkenton and all that. You know, I was a Rams fan as well. Grew up in L.A., but I was a huge Vikings fan. I don't know if it was the helmet, horn, and Fran Tarkenton or whatever, and the Purple People Eaters and the whole nine yards. So it was great fun to go to Minneapolis with Denny, where I spent the next 10 years.
Well, and the story of your career has been, you know, it's the next opportunity, and you've certainly did the job well at the Minnesota Vikings, and then the opportunity comes for you to be a head coach in the NFL with the Baltimore Ravens. And they're obviously a fairly new franchise, not having come from Cleveland, but now in Baltimore. What was that like when you get that job? Because in the coaching ranks, there's nothing higher than an NFL head coach. What was that accomplishment? What did that mean to you?
Well, we had had a lot of success in Minnesota in that 98 team. That I was the offensive coordinator, where we broke the all-time scoring record. It was a magical team with unbelievable talent. Randy Moss and Chris Carter and Andrew Glover at tight end and Randall Cunningham at quarterback and Robert Smith at running back. We had just unbelievable talent. It was a phenomenal year. We go 15-1. And so that obviously garners interest from the typical path of those that are looking for head coaches in the NFL. So after the season, there were a couple teams that kind of had approached me. Baltimore was a new team. The other one was the Cleveland Browns. Now, they had not reconstituted yet. They were going to be a new franchise, which was a little bit of a concern, taking over an entirely new franchise. But Baltimore had struggled a little bit, had reconstituted itself in Baltimore. The big thing there for me was Ozzie Newsome, the Hall of Fame legendary player, tight end, now Hall of Fame general manager. And Denny Green, who was a huge mentor of mine, really felt like Ozzie and I would work well together. So that's what kind of leaned me towards taking the opportunity. But you talk about preparing yourself. It's amazing. You know, like anybody in a profession, you work hard, you try to distinguish yourself, you prepare yourself for that job and what I'm going to do and be able to present that image to ownership and say, okay, I'm your guy. I'm the guy you need to hire. And it was a whirlwind. We lose in the championship game. I'm in Cleveland. I'm in Baltimore. Kansas City's talking to me. San Diego's talking to me. I fly into Baltimore. We solidify the deal. I'm the head coach of the Baltimore Ravens. And I remember going into my office for the first time and sitting down and thinking, what do I do now? It's like, you know, what's next? And you just go to work and you just do those things that you, but I remember that feeling of, oh my, now that I've got it, what do I do now? And we're able to put together some pretty successful things and brought good people into the organization, as well as Art Modell, just a legendary owner, wonderful man, had great people in the organization, even though they had not been winning. So to kind of meld with them and build that going forward, just an incredible experience.
Well, you certainly did go to work, and Baltimore was rewarded for hiring you in that position because you ended up winning the Super Bowl in just the fourth season, I believe, as a franchise in Baltimore.
Yeah, fourth in the franchise, but just my second season.
Yeah, just your second year as the head coach. Can you even describe what that's like to be holding that trophy at the end and knowing you're an NFL champion?
It's humbling and it's frightening. Tell you a true story. Of course, we had worked that year and we didn't know we were that good, but we thought we were pretty good. We had just an absolutely incredible defense like no one had ever seen. It was amazing to go from the highest scoring offense in the history of the NFL in 98 to 2000, the lowest scoring defense in the history of the NFL. Unbelievable group. Again, with the players, you had Ray Lewis, Rod Woodson on the back end, Peter Bowlwear and Mike McCreary on the edge, Tony Siragusa in the middle. Just a phenomenal group of athletes, very focused on being the best. And we were. And we lost, Mike, the 74 team. We lost three games in a row. We lost four out of five games in the month of October. Now, you talk about the ability to rip a team apart, particularly in a professional environment, but that team hung together. And I always say, we went on an 11-game winning streak and beating New York in the Super Bowl 35. I don't believe we'd have had that kind of run had we not been through that baptism together of sticking together through more difficult times. And so when you get to the playoffs and we rolled through the playoffs, we did, and beat the New York Giants, overwhelmed them, and all of a sudden you're standing on that stage, it's a surreal moment. And I'll tell you honestly, so you win the game, and naturally the party that ensues afterwards, you go back to the hotel, and the Modells have put on this unbelievable party. These tents, and I mean, we're up all night long. It was unbelievable. Well, in the infinite wisdom of the NFL, they decide that the winning head coach should have an 8 a.m. news conference in front of the national media, who were all pissed off at me anyway, because the way I'd come into the game and called them ambulance chasers and all that stuff because of the Ray Lewis situation. So I wasn't their favorite person to begin with. So about 6 o'clock, 6:30, I kind of pull my way away from the party, figuring, oh, I'm going to go back to the suite and shower and kind of refresh myself. I get into the shower and I have, for lack of a better term, a panic attack, because it was like, what do I do now? I mean, we've won the Super Bowl in just the second year. What are the expectations? What, you know, now, and the first, it's not 10 minutes after you win a Super Bowl. The very first question, can you do it again? You know, it's like, can I have an hour? Can I just enjoy this for an hour before I have to start thinking about how to go back and do this again? So it's an exhilarating time. And then for that city to be able to bring the championship to that city, given its history of the Colts leaving, it was a very, very special time.
And you were the head coach in Baltimore for 8 seasons. Is that right?
Nine seasons.
So everyone's going to handle a situation like this differently, but it's never easy when someone says, we're going to go in a different direction. How did you handle the decision when they decided to let you go?
Well, it's a business decision. I understood that because I had let coaches go for a myriad of reasons. And it's just a business decision. It was a bit of a shock. Did not expect it. The year before, we had gone 13-3. They had given me a brand new contract. And then the next year we lose our quarterback, we lose Ray Lewis, we lose Jonathan Ogden, we're beset with injuries, and we go like 5-11. So it was a shock. It's a shock to the system, but you understand it. That's the business, you know, and you move on, fully intending to go back into coaching. I get the opportunity to get into the broadcasting, which I thought I'd do for a bit, keep me close to the game and still then see what manifested itself going forward in terms of coaching. So I did games for Fox. I did studio shows for the NFL Network, which was great fun. Enjoyed it. Learned a lot. The great thing about Fox, imagine this, every Friday, because I'm doing games, so you go to the city where the game is, and every Friday you're going to the facility of the home team, and you spend the day there, and you're watching practice. In many cases, coaches let me sit in meetings. I mean, can you imagine? I always said, had I gone back into coaching, I would have been a better coach just for that experience, for sitting in virtually every facility in the National Football League, watching how other people did it, watching how other organizations did it. Did that for 6 years. But after a while, there were a couple opportunities the first couple of years, but it wasn't the right match. I had promised myself that I wasn't going to go back just for anything. I knew it's a marriage, and it had to be a good marriage. I had come out of a pretty good marriage with Ozzie Newsome, so I knew what it looked like. So I wasn't going to go into a bad second relationship. So the right opportunities really didn't present itself. And then after a while, you know, they just quit asking, you know, and then the TV career kind of took off. So I did that for 12 years, enjoyed it. But then that too even got to a point where it's, okay, that's been fun, but maybe I need to do something else now.
Well, Brian, I have one last question for you and we will let you go. This has been an absolute pleasure. Whether it's certainly a long coaching career at many different levels, being now a BYU Hall of Famer, winning the Super Bowl and being a Super Bowl winning coach, looking back, how blessed were you to have been put in a position to earn so many amazing opportunities and accolades?
And so much of it is fate. I mean, you work hard and you try to maximize every opportunity you get. But like ending up at BYU and that unique relationship and looking back on those relationships. And I said this at the 74 event and then at the Hall of Fame banquet as well. Very proud of my association with BYU. The NCAA college football, college athletics needs BYU desperately right now. College athletics is under attack by way of the NIL and the portal and everything about it that shoves the business side at college athletics. The direction, the moral clarity that a BYU can provide for the NCAA right now is so vitally important. I'm very proud of the association with BYU. It's great fun to watch the success they have and look forward to seeing them doing even bigger and better things.
Well, Brian, this conversation has been amazing. Thank you so much for being willing to do it. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks once again to my guest, Brian Billick. My name is Jason Shepard. Josh Bergstrom and Ben Hall produced this episode. Deep Blue's senior producer is Cleon Wall. You can download and subscribe to Deep Blue on all podcast platforms or find all episodes on the BYU Radio app. Deep Blue is a production of BYU Radio.